We are Radio Catskill.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition. On a Friday evening, I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. In the second half of the show, we'll learn more about how the mind works. A new documentary is coming up next week at the Calicoon Theater. I talked to one of the participants in the documentary, who's also a neuroscientist and a musician. Cool combination. But first, U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer visited Sullivan County yesterday. He was here to announce a new bill aimed at reversing President Trump's Medicaid cuts. Schumer stood side by side with local lawmakers, Assemblymember Paula Kay, and Sullivan County Legislature Chair Nadia Reich, along with other community leaders. Lawmakers estimate that 1.5 million New Yorkers could lose health care coverage if the law is enacted. But for rural areas like Sullivan County, where there are fewer hospitals and a larger percentage of residents on Medicaid compared to urban areas, the cuts could be a make-or-break moment. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar brings us this report.
Standing at the entrance of the Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills Harris campus, New York State Senator Chuck Schumer said enough is enough. At a press conference on Thursday in Sullivan County, Schumer announced new legislation that would reverse President Trump's Medicaid cuts and extend health care tax credits.
The fallout is just starting here in the Hudson Valley, and it paints a dark picture. Longer wait times, higher health care costs, reduced medical services, layoffs, or even closures, which our rural hospitals are especially vulnerable to.
He urged that Trump's big, beautiful bill takes money out of the pockets of Hudson Valley residents and into the pockets of the ultra-wealthy.
Why are they cutting these things? Only one reason. They want to give tax breaks to billionaires. I have nothing against billionaires. You know, that's, they made their money. God bless them. But they don't need a tax break when a mother with cancer might not be able to get the treatment that her child needs.
Schumer's new legislation is called the Protecting Healthcare and Lowering Costs Act. It proposes to repeal all healthcare cuts outlined in Trump's Big Beautiful Bill and permanently extend the Affordable Care Act's premium tax credits that are set to expire at the end of December. The entire Democratic caucus has signed on to co-sponsor the legislation. About 150,000 people could lose health care, and 7,000 workers could lose their jobs in the Catskills and the Hudson Valley regions alone as a result of the cuts, says Schumer. Jerry Dunleavy, CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills, says he's hopeful that the proposed legislation could provide Sullivan County with much needed relief.
Oh, it affect us tremendously. So if you think about it, about 30 to 35% of our patients are on Medicaid. The 19th congressional district alone is estimated to have 37,500 patients that are going to lose their coverage. Not all, that's not all Sullivan County, that's in the district. And if we can get this groundswell of community support, perhaps we could reverse all or part of these cuts.
More than half of the state's 50 rural hospitals were already at risk of closing even before Trump's tax cut and spending bill passed, according to data from the Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform. Garnet Health's Catskill Harris campus was considered one of the hospitals on that list at immediate risk of closing due to loss of patient services and declining revenues. Earlier this summer, Garnet Health laid off 42 employees and scaled back its outpatient diabetes and pulmonary rehab services to manage financial constraints. Dr. Pamela Murphy is the chief medical officer at Garnet Health. She said that cuts to Medicaid would mean patients would be forced to make difficult decisions.
The bottom line is these Medicaid cuts will impact us tremendously. Just think about when your coverage is reduced, your enrollment is lost. It is either because you lose eligibility or you face new work requirements that you can't do. You have a gap in enrollment. These often lead to really hard choices. Am I going to put food on the table or am I going to get my prescription filled? Am I going to go to my follow-up appointment? Can I seek a checkup appointment? Can I get lab work or testing that the doctor recommends me to get? Am I not going to fill that prescription because you know what? It's too much for me this month. I'm going to buy something else for my child. I'm going to put food on the table. My child needs a new pair of shoes. Something that takes away because we can't afford it. Some won't schedule follow-up visits after they've been in our hospital. We need follow-up care. We need continued care. We need preventative health.
Sylvan County Legislature Chair Nadia Raj says she'll do everything she can to keep the doors of the county's few hospitals left open.
Sylvan County has over 28,000 people on Medicaid, more than one-third of the population, one in every three people. Can you imagine if even some of them lost Medicaid, what would happen to them? It's appalling. I'm appalled and saddened as to what is happening down with our administration in Washington, D.C. I'm really grateful to the senator for being there and advocating for us. The impacts of losing Medicaid and of not providing Medicaid to our residents in need will have devastating effects like we've just heard. This will impact their health care, the health care facilities, emergency services, to which many of them are struggling now. Our county does not have the resources to provide for this lapse of service. Our residents deserve better, and we are grateful, Senator, for your voice and your support. And I, along with my Democratic legislators, will do everything we can to support Garnett in their stability and being open.
Senator Schumer says he plans to introduce the bill as soon as Democrats return to legislative session following Labor Day. He urged the public to contact their Republican lawmakers to support his bill. In Harris, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly, for that report. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is the Local Edition. I'm Patricio Robayo. Stay tuned.
You are listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's certainly true that Donald Trump needs a ceasefire to come out of this conversation, whereas Putin wins just by showing up, right?
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Welcome back to the Local Edition on a Tuesday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Earlier this week, I spoke with neuroscientist and musician Joseph Ledoux about his role in Werner Herzog's Theater of Thought, a new documentary partially filmed in Kolchak, New York. The documentary explores the mysteries of the human mind. This was a film screening that was supposed to show in February, but it got snowed out. So they were having a screening next week, Thursday, August 21st at 7:30 at the Calicon Theater. And the documentary is followed by a talkback moderated by our very own Jason Tugar with a live performance from Joseph and Colin Dempsey as Heavy Mental, with songs about the brain, mind, and mental health. I spoke to Joseph about his career and how he ended up in this documentary and his life as a musician.
This is a documentary by Werner Herzog, one of the most acclaimed directors of all time. And so I was very surprised one Saturday night when I was sitting up in my house in Coshocton to get a phone call from a friend who was in, I think, Seattle, with a camera crew, and they were interviewing scientists for this show that Herzog wanted to do. And they said that my name came up over dinner, and would I be interested in talking to him on Monday? This was Saturday night. And I said, sure. I said, but I'm up in the Catskills. And he said, well, that's no problem. Let's take Werner and the whole crew up there. So they arrived on Monday afternoon and started setting up, and you know, he knew a little bit about me. And so when he saw a guitar lying around, he said, we'll start playing that in case we want to use anything. So I started playing. And about the third song in, he said, that one. I said, okay. So he just held that in mind. And the interview started. One of the first things he asked me was, well, I understand that your father was a bull rider when he was young. And then he started riding bulls again when he was 60 years old. So we went off from there into all kinds of stuff, and we talked about my work a bit, my music, and you know, life in general. Spent an hour or two together like that, and went out on the deck and had cheese and crackers at Werner Herzog and some wine. So how can you beat that?
Yeah, I mean, like, Werner, you know, he's always known for his unique approach in his acting or things, projects that he does. And you mentioned a little bit, but what was your experience being interviewed by him? You know, you spent 2 hours with the man.
He was delicious, delightful, delicious, but wonderful to talk to. Very relaxed, and he just, you know, he is sitting there with the camera in his hand and adjusting things and talking. The cameramen are doing their take, and he's just sort of sitting there very close to me, and we're just chatting. It was very comfortable. It wasn't, wasn't upset or stressed or anything. It was just like very comfortable to talk to him. Asked me lots of questions about my life, starting with my father, as I said. I am growing up in Cajun country in South Louisiana. How I became a scientist, which was kind of accidental. I had 2 degrees in marketing from LSU, business and marketing. And then I kind of fell into a class that was called Learning and Motivation. I thought it was about consumer motivation, and it was about rats and memory. And that from there, I decided that's what I wanted to do. So it was just, you know, we talked about those kinds of things. And I went on to be a neuroscientist from there.
Wow, that's great. These, from what I understand, that the film blends science and philosophy questions about memory and the brain. You know, what moment stood out to you that sort of thought provoking for you?
I think there's probably 15 or 20 other scientists in the film. And right now that you're asking me, I'm having trouble recollecting exactly who said what, because this happened. I saw it in December, but that's the first and only time I've seen it. I mean, there was a lot of talk about AI. There was some talk about memory. There were talks about the environment, I think. You know, it was just kind of all over the place. And he, you know, he navigates it well, and he goes in lots of directions right in the middle of the screening that you'll see on Thursday, the 21st, is the tightrope walker. What's his name? The guy that walked between the World Trade Center.
Oh, yeah.
He's in there, and who the hell knows what he's doing in there? But, you know, he lives in the Hudson Valley. And so I guess they said, we're going to go there first, and then they'll go to the Catskills. But I don't know why they picked him in particular. I think it was because of fear,
yeah.
You know, his ability to walk across that. And fear is one of the things that I've worked on a lot. So maybe that's the connection. The lovely thing about it is he shows that piece with the tightrope walker doing his practice sessions at the very end over the credits. And that's one of the 3 songs that of mine that he put in the show. The closing act was a song called, the closing song was called When the Night is Dark. And it's about people who are afraid of the daytime rather than the dark. But he's obviously not afraid of anything, but they timed it so they got the music and his practice session on the tightrope perfectly integrated. So it's fun to watch that. The other songs that are in it, mine is one is called Map of Your Mind. That's the one he said, that's the one I want. And in the film, he shows there's a video of a car going up a hill. I don't know if that was their car, but they're on this road trip. And so I start singing in my living room in Coshocton. And they use that part for the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds of the film. And then they perfectly blend in the recorded version of it and use that throughout the rest of the scenery of driving through the mountains and so forth. You know, it was very creative all around. They did a fantastic job. It was just two guys with cameras and one scientist and a runner.
Let's talk about your background. You know, a neuroscientist and also a musician. How does, you know, that how you balance a career in both neuroscience and music, and how those two worlds influence each other?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because, you know, at some point, I would say when I was close to 50 years old, 1980, must have been 86 or so, 85, 86, I was playing guitar with a friend from the biology department at NYU, both NYU faculty, and we'd both written books for lay people. And so we'd get together and play these songs, and we were kind of like, somehow locking into some of the 60s greats that were about mind and brain, like Jimi Hendrix's Manic Depression, Rolling Stones, Mother's Little Helpers about the drugs for, you know, benzos and stuff, and 90s Nervous Breakdown, songs like that. Those became some of the songs we would kind of play when we do something for a Christmas party or a lab party or something. But we did a lot of other covers. But then I got invited to give a lecture at a place in Park Slope in Brooklyn called Union Hall. And this was to a group called the Secret Science Club. It's just a bunch of enthusiasts, science enthusiasts who live in Brooklyn. And they said, well, you know, we'll have some entertainment after. I said, well, I'll bring the entertainment. So that was going to be me and Tyler. But then we found out in the meantime that my new postdoc, a young lady from Israel, Daniela Schiller, who became a regular faculty member at Mount Sinai, which is a very esteemed neuroscientist now. At the time, she was a postdoc, and she also played drums. So she said, yeah, I played drums. And she said, my research assistant plays bass. Hmm. So we had it, two guitars, drum, and a bass. That's all we needed. So we went on to Park Slope. I'd written a couple of songs in this vein. One was called The Mind-Body Problem, and it's kind of a spoof. It says, you know, I got a mind-body problem. I don't know what to do. My body wants you so, but my mind says no. So it was kind of a jokey song. The other one was When the Night is Dark. That's the song that Werner used in the credits. And so, you know, the audience really liked the two songs that I'd written. And so I said, okay, I got some stimulation from that. And I started writing more and more songs. And we started playing more and more. And, you know, we in NYU got really into it. The press office would advertise anytime we had a gig. We were in Greenwich Village, so there were lots of places to play and have a good time. And so we had a show in the basement of it was a jazz club in the basement of a cafe on Cornelia Street in the Village. And at the show was, I forget his name, the person who the Beautiful Mind book was named after, oh. was about. I forget his name, but this is a very physicist from Princeton. And he was there, as was Oliver Sacks. And they asked the Beautiful Mind guy, so what did you think of the music? He said, oh, it's psychoanalytic. So at the same time, there was a New York Times reporter there, and she wrote an article in the New York Times, say the title of which was A Band of Scientists Who Really Are a Band. And so it was like one thing like that after another, and just kept taking off. And, you know, and I was playing music all the time. We had all these gigs. We went to the Kennedy Center in Washington. We'd play in New York all the time. And I kept wondering, you know, is NYU really going to, like, allow me to spend this much time doing this? And they didn't slow down. They just let me do it. We played at NYU's graduation at Madison Square Garden. There's a YouTube video on this where you got 7,000 people in there, like 5,000 of the students, maybe it's 10,000, I don't know, but the students are all on the floor sitting in seats there. And we were playing one of our songs and they started doing the wave. And then all of the people in the stadium around that, all the family and friends who were there, started doing the wave. So it was this really energizing kind of stuff that was just happening to us. I mean, I'm certainly not a great musician. Tyler was very good, and Danielle was a great drummer. I was the weak link in the chain there, but they, you know, they were having a good time. I was having a good time writing songs, and over the years we published or did five or six, I think six albums altogether.
Oh, wow.
And I've done some on my own. Yeah, it's all on YouTube, and one of our YouTube videos, which was actually shot up here in an old barn, is called Fearing. It's a takeoff on a Emily Dickinson poem. And the video on YouTube has almost 100,000 views. That was shot by Noah Hutton. And that was that's our most famous musical video, and probably song, because so many people have seen it. You know, and these days I get asked to give a lot of lectures. And, you know, it's been something that I've done a lot of over the years. But now, I would say in the last 10 years, almost always they ask me to bring the amygdala. And I say, no, I can't, but I can bring Colin. And that's why Colin will be with us on next Thursday night, because without him, I can't pull this off by myself. So we've been to Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Rome, Stockholm, London. We've, you know, been all over the place doing this stuff.
That's awesome. I think you found a new career in a way.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not talking about the film very much here.
Yeah, no, but that's fine. I'm interested in your work, because something, when you mention what you work on, I understand that, you know, you work about evolving, help people coping with fear or study fear. And I just read a book called Run Towards the Danger by Sarah Polley, I believe. And she talks about, you know, she had a concussion And it turned her life around as far as like she was afraid to do anything. She was like, couldn't get out of bed. And she went to this, neurologist, I believe. And basically the cure for it was to do things that scare you. And that's way how mm-hmm. she can go over the thing. Is that something you work on in your line of work as a neuroscientist?
Well, you know, I was a laboratory researcher. I spent 50 years or at least 45 years on studying rats and memory and emotion, especially fear. And it, you know, my work was applied over a lot of the years was applied to various types of therapeutic approaches, or at least researched to find therapeutic approaches based on the findings that I had in rats. So it was a very productive time. And I wrote a book in 2015 called Anxious. So yeah, fear and anxiety were a big part of the implications of my work, not so much the work I was doing. But, you know, in the middle of, so maybe towards three quarters of the way through my career, I decided that, you know, a lot of my work was responsible for putting the brain area known as the amygdala mm-hmm. on the map as a fear center. Everybody knows the amygdala now. It's in books, it's in novels, it's in plays, it's in songs, you name it, it's everywhere. It was on NPR the other day, this hidden brain story. And so I played a big role in getting that thing going. And then I would say around 2012, it started to get a little bit uncomfortable with the whole thing. Because, you know, if you think about what fear is, it's really a kind of psychological state. And every psychological state in a human is going to be much, much more complex than anything in a rat or a mouse or a bird or anything else. I mean, the birds are able to do some great things. But our conscious minds are incredibly more complex than any other animal because our brain is much more complex. You know, I came to think of emotions not as these innate things. The innate things are correct. The amygdala is an innate structure going back in time and evolution for a long way. But it does not make fear. What it does is it detects and responds to danger. Every animal that's ever lived, every organism that's ever lived, all the way back to the earliest cell that ever lived has to detect danger, or otherwise it can't get through the day. Now, so I decided, you know, my hypothesis was that the amygdala is not a fear center. It's a defensive survival circuit. And fear is a cognitive interpretation of the situation we're in. Now, the book you're talking about, and the person is told to, you know, face your fear, basically. I mean, that can work, but it can also go the other direction. It'll get back on the saddle idea, but sometimes that makes things worse. So, you know, I don't know the book. I don't know the author, so I can't really say anything. But I think that what you have to do in my perspective is help the patient change the narrative that the person is a fearful person, the narrative that the person is an anxious person, the narrative that the person is a depressed person. You're none of those things. You have symptoms that you can change, and each person may need a different kind of therapy to make the change. And they may also need different multiple kinds of therapy because, you know, a lot of what we say and do, like I'm talking to you, I'm not planning a single word of this. We just picked up the phone and I started talking. I'm talking to you non-consciously. I just started talking to you consciously because I interrupted myself to tell you how I was talking non-consciously. And that's really how our brains work, that almost everything we do non-consciously. But at the same time, we have a monitoring system that if something important seems to happen, you bounce it up a level to a conscious process. And that's when we go from a kind of automatic fear, not the amygdala kind, but the automatic cognitive interpretation of danger, which begins to marshal your energy onto one where I better get the hell out of here. I better figure out what to do, talking to yourself consciously. And then all of that feeds together. I know this is getting too complicated, but basically the idea is we have two outputs simultaneously. One output is to your body for behavior on the basis of non-conscious cognition, and the other is an output to your prefrontal cortex for conscious cognition. And it's the combination of those. Let's say that you might have some people who are going to need treatment for that non-conscious part of it, and others that are maybe going to need more treatment for the conscious part. And the problem is, if one of them is not working properly, then it's going to mess up the other one. So this is a whole new way of thinking that, you know, I've begun to put in my books, my last book, Four Realms of Existence. And also I have a memoir coming out, probably not for another year, but it plays a big role in my memoir about how we change narratives and what narratives we need to change and how you might do that and all that kind of stuff. All right, sorry I rambled on non-consciously.
No, that's fine. I mean, but honestly, I'm interested in this because my father's currently going through Alzheimer's. So I'm just so wrapped up on how the mind works and how age plays into the mind and like all these connections you made through life and how it can just go away. And then I'm rambling also. But.
So let me just say a bit about that. You know what? Yeah. There, in this book, The Four Realms of Existence, I forget about the first one because it's just biology, which is just staying alive.
Right.
But the second realm is the automatic realm, the amygdala type realm. Now, that is an unconscious processor. So it's doing all these things completely unconsciously, automatically. The next realm is the cognitive realm, where you can have non-conscious processes, but they're not automatic. They're cognitively based. And then the conscious level is where you are having conscious interpretations. So each of those is going to be affected differently in Alzheimer's. Like my mother had it pretty bad. She was an accordion player, Cajun accordion player. And she couldn't remember a thing, but she could play her accordion. That's that amygdala, basal ganglia, low, low level automatic response stuff that can become a habit and you can do over and over again. The next level, the cognitive level, is not habitual. It's goal directed. It's trying to find solutions by comparing other solutions to it. And that's happening non-consciously. And then, you know, the conscious brain is one of the most energy demanding things in the body. And so we have this non-conscious cognition, which doesn't demand as much energy. So that is the baseline. And when things really heat up, you bump it up to consciousness because you have to make some more kind of determined decisions in the final moment of what are you going to do with the situation that you're in. So that takes up a lot of energy, burns a lot of fuel in your brain. And so that only kicks in on an as needed basis. Mm.
The brain is just an amazing organ.
Yeah. And it's the cognitive and the conscious that are, I think, going in Alzheimer's, that the person forgets who you are and forgets what's important and stuff. They still have a lot of habits at that low level.
Right. I guess that's why, you know, people who are going to that would remember things that happened in the past, but are not getting the things that are happening right now in front of them within like the last 5 minutes. But they can remember stories from the past and things like that. So amazing. Well, you know, I said the talk back is happening on Thursday after this film and folks can expect, your insight, that you're giving us right now. It's amazing. And now, how long is the documentary, by the way? That's the information I don't know.
It's about 2 hours.
2 hours. And it's happening on Thursday, 21st. The 21st at 7:30 at the Calicoon Theater. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for talking to me about this and about your work. Thank you so much for doing this. I said the Theater of Thought is happening. A new documentary partially filmed in Constructed New York, Thursday, August 21st, 7:30 at the Calicoon Theater. Again, thank you so much, Joseph. Do really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And that does it for the Local Edition on this Friday evening. Was your host, Patricio Robayo. Everyone enjoy this weekend. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, stay safe. And I'll talk to you soon.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.